Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. Few, if any, 21st century North Carolinians have brought more passion, eloquence, or determination to the fight against poverty and injustice than Professor Gene Nickel of the University of North Carolina School of Law and the North Carolina Poverty Research Fund. For decades now, Nickel has served as a bold, provocative, courageous, and prolific leader and spokesperson in the cause of economic and social justice in our state. Recently, along with his Poverty Center colleague, Heather Hunt, Nickel has authored a new book that provides a scathing assessment of North Carolina's failure to address the poverty that afflicts so many of its citizens. The book is entitled The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina. Nickel spoke at a Policy Watch luncheon earlier this month, and afterwards, he sat down for an extended interview with News & Views producer Clayton Hinkle.
Gene, before we talk about your new book, The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, Stories from Our Invisible Citizens, let's talk about why you decided to tackle a subject you've been focused on all of your life. Why now did you decide to write this book?
Well, the challenge of poverty in North Carolina, just like in the broader country, but even worse, is, I think, clearly the greatest problem that we face. It's been true for a long time. It remains true. But despite the fact that it's such a crushing issue and challenge, it doesn't make its way into our public discourse very much. It plays no part in our debates over public policy. It's largely absent from our broader cultural work. I work on university campuses. It's frequently missing from university campuses. It's often missing even from our pulpits, and it's certainly missing from our deliberations in the State House with our public officials. So it's odd that we could have what I think sensibly has to be seen as our largest challenge, but it doesn't make its way into our public life or dispute or discussions, at least in anything like the measure that you would think it would. So my goal is to try and pull back a little bit what is invisible to lots of us, that is the poverty amidst plenty in this state. And also, we intentionally make it invisible, at least a lot of us do, I think. So my purpose is to try and pull that veil back a little bit, and I try to do it mainly through the words of low-income folks in North Carolina and the remarkable people who struggle to try and help them have a better plight.
You're absolutely right that in many ways these are invisible people, because when we do talk about poverty, it's easy to get wrapped up in the subject and just looking at the data. We don't think about what day-to-day life looks like for those individuals. You point out, though, that poverty is sharply skewed in our state by race, sex, and whether you have children.
It is. And in a sense, none of those are surprising. But the degree to which they persist is stunning, really. Race, of course, most potently, is the kind of handmaiden of poverty in North Carolina. It has been, frankly, since the days of our beginning, and it remains so. That increases its invisibility for a lot of North Carolinians. As you know, family structure, the sort of impoverishment of women has a big impact on our Commonwealth. We also end up having the poorest be the youngest, the most vulnerable among us. Before I started looking at poverty issues 20 or 30 years ago, I wouldn't have guessed that it would be the youngest, our kids, who suffer the most from poverty. That doesn't say very much about a people. But whether you're looking at hunger or poverty, the sort of ancillaries which accompany them, the youngest Tar Heels are the most vulnerable. And that's inexcusable, I think, for us. So I try hard here to shine a light on the challenges of poverty in North Carolina that we don't look at as profoundly as we should, and certainly that we don't address as potently as we should.
Let's talk a little bit more about children who are living in poverty. We know that one in five children in our state are living below or at the poverty line. But what sort of impact does that have on a child's education and their chance to rise above that level and get out of poverty and build a better life?
Well, our high levels of child poverty have dramatic impacts on our future, on the likely success of our children in many ways. One, obviously well documented, is that we have in the United States now, and it's even worse, generally speaking, in North Carolina, very poor income mobility rates. I think famously 3 years ago in Charlotte, the Stanford-Harvard studies indicated that Charlotte had the worst income mobility of any major city in the United States, 50th out of 50. So that means that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you're more apt to stay that way than anywhere else in the country. That's an immensely crushing verdict to deliver about a community like Mecklenburg County, particularly the wealthiest city in North Carolina. But you asked about education, and of course, poverty and the impacts of poverty spread far more broadly than even just questions of income mobility. They affect, of course, housing, the safety and affordability of housing for children. And poverty has the largest impact on the quality of education in North Carolina, as any other factor that can be identified. The gap between those who are poorest and those who thrive economically in terms of student achievement and student possibility is intense. It's worse than racial separations and polarizations now. That's reflected in all these rankings that we do of our schools, of course. What they really indicate is how many poor kids attend a certain school. But in this book, one of the things I wanted to do that I think there's some modest success at is to try and move past the statistics and to talk about the impact on folks' lives and do that based on people who could discuss it. I thought, how do you do that for poor kids? You're not going to interview the poor kids. Parents are frequently reluctant to talk about the parents of poor kids about the challenges that they face. So I interviewed lots and lots of Title I teachers in Raleigh, Durham, sort of across the triangle, some in Charlotte, some in Greensboro. And they described with real heartache, in my judgment, heartbreak, the challenges that their kids face day in and day out, not having enough to eat, not having anyone at home when they come home in the afternoon, students in the third or fourth grade having to care for younger students, running out of food towards the end of the month. The notion that what these teachers say, surprisingly or unsurprisingly, I mean, is that if we think that kids who can't get enough to eat or who are fearful for their safety or who have the electricity turned off when they go home, that they're going to have some sort of equal competitive shot and that they're going to be concentrating on these end-of-grade tests, that's absurd. And so I think when you look more deeply at the lives being experienced by low-income folks and their children, you move past the data. And you, I think, more readily recognize that this just cannot be tolerated in one of the most economically vibrant states of the richest nation in human history.
Another challenge beyond that that is certainly an impact on the economic well-being of individuals and families is health care. You have a chapter called Inequality in Health, and you open that with a story of Tanya Hall, who lives in a hosky, and one of the things she says right up front is that she lives in fear and that her children live in fear simply because she doesn't have health care. And I think that's something that so many of our listeners can probably relate to.
I think that's right. And I think that it's not as readily revealed in the debates, the sort of ideological debates about what healthcare should be like, or the ideological debates about whether we should extend Medicaid, or whether we should have the latest version of Obamacare, or we should ditch it, or the like. The statistics are horrifying. We're the richest nation on earth. We spend more on healthcare per capita than anybody, but we leave far more outside the system, recognizing that they're not going to be able to get healthcare. And in North Carolina, that every year, by not extending Medicaid, for example, 1,000 or more Tar Heels die. as a result of that. But it's a little different to talk to people who don't have health care, to talk to the fear that they carry, to talk to folks who have a strong medical history and family history of cancer, who can't get screenings that they need, to talk to doctors who work in emergency rooms, who say, people think that we always give folks the health care they need because people can sometimes come into emergency rooms and they're not going to be turned away. I said, but you can't get a pap smear in an emergency room. You can't get the screenings that you need. Frequently, folks can't get health care until it is too late under that circumstance, and of course, the most expensive. And yet, horribly, we refuse to expand Medicaid. The legislature can't even give a thoughtful reason for why it's done it. It cost us tremendously economically in this state, but the economic toll is nothing like the death toll which exists. So in the book, there are doctors who describe patients who have died because of the unwillingness to extend Medicaid. They talk about people who died because they were North Carolinians. If they had lived in one of the other 30, whatever it is now, 35 states, 34 states who've expanded Medicaid, they would have lived. But they died here because they're Tar Heels. And I think most people don't recognize that. If they do and they're not horrified by it, then I think we have even larger challenges and problems.
Indeed, you can say if we do happen to expand Medicaid in the future, that's well and fine. It's commendable. It's what we should have done all along. But if you've lost your mother or your sister to cancer, that's really cold comfort.
It is a cold comfort, indeed. And I think not enough of us recognize how strongly we're the outlier on this. The United States itself, though, as I said, spending more on health care, leaving far more people outside in the shadows than any other advanced nation. And then North Carolina, through its bullheaded ideological decisions, leaving us in worse shape than other states are in this regard. And then, of course, we have the remnants of the South leading us here, too. The South, which I think of as the native home of poverty, meaning we have more poor people and more politicians who are utterly untroubled by it than the rest of the land. All these programs that we would disproportionately benefit from, the southern states, we seem to have the greatest apprehension towards, which I must say would confuse Madison. I'm an old sort of constitutional theory person, and Madison wouldn't have thought you could so readily put aside the economic interest of the bottom 55%, but we do that with some real skill and regularity in North Carolina.
When we look at our state, we often talk about two North Carolinas, rural versus urban, but one of the things I thought you did quite well and effectively in this book is you looked at Charlotte, you looked at Goldsboro, you looked at Wilkes County, home of the first NASCAR race, home of Lowe's, and you showed that poverty is rampant in all of those communities, all of them very diverse, residents impacted across the board.
And when we started doing research on intense poverty in North Carolina, some in our little shop maybe 6 or 8 years ago, we were surprised to learn that even though the general description of poverty in North Carolina, rural versus urban, that general claim being that we have intense, persistent intergenerational poverty in much of rural North Carolina, particularly in the east, some in the west, and then we have these cities that just go gangbusters. There's truth in that picture, but there's a missing component of it too, because we learned, looking at census tracts, that the very deepest poverty in North Carolina is right in the middle of Charlotte, Durham, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, sometimes even in Wake County. The deepest poverty challenges, the deepest mobility challenges, heavily racialized, concentrated poverty. So its averages can conceal truths. No one's going to think of Mecklenburg County as a poor county. But if you want to find some of the deepest poverty in North Carolina, you'll find it right in the middle of Charlotte. And we spent a lot of time interviewing folks from those communities in Charlotte. Here's one other thing that I know we're all looking for heartening things. This is disheartening, but also heartening. At the same time that I was spending about a year in Wayne County in Goldsboro and in Wilkes County over in the west, two very different demographically communities. In Wilkes County, where there is very intense poverty, long intergenerational poverty, and tremendous economic hardship, you know, with blankets over the windows and seven or eight people living in a little mobile home, very tough circumstances. But out front, there would be a Trump sign and a Confederate flag. Then on the other hand, we spent a lot of time in public housing projects in Goldsboro, a very different subset, all folks, mostly black and brown, same levels of intense poverty and challenge, same sort of hardship from the recession and from NAFTA. And clearly there were no Trump signs and Confederate flags to be found in the tough public housing projects in Goldsboro. So those two groups would consider themselves cultural adversaries, probably. But when you ask them what they wanted, what they feared, what they needed, what they thought would help them the most to thrive, who they trusted, who they didn't, their answers were very, very similar. So the low-income folks in Wayne County and the low-income folks in Wilkes County had much more in common than they would have guessed. So if you ever find someone who can help those two groups of people understand how much they have in common rather than how split apart they are, if there's ever anyone brilliant enough, it takes somebody a lot smarter than me to do that. But we could solve the political problems of North Carolina. We could solve the representational problems of North Carolina if low-income folks realized how much they have in common rather than engaging in what has been one of the South's largest pastimes for 200 years of this politics of racial division.
Our time is drawing short, but one of the things you say in conclusion is that we need to take the blinders off our eyes. These are real people, and I imagine that you're speaking not just to the people on Jones Street or in Washington who can do something about this, but individuals as well who may turn a blind eye, as you say in your title, to the invisible citizens.
I think that's right. I think we have a gigantic government problem in this. I'm not denying that, and I think that we've moved from a government that sort of ignores the plight of the poor to one that targets poor people and acts to make their lives more difficult. But it's not just a government problem. I have kind of four sort of reactions, having spent the last 10 years in low-income communities in North Carolina. The first is that the level of hardship, economic distress, is much more pronounced than most of us think. It's much more debilitating. So the problem is worse. That's number one. Secondly, in every corner of North Carolina, there are people doing work which is so selfless, so astonishing in its generosity, just to try and make life a little better for those who they think are having a harder time of it, that it can hardly even be stated or described. I've tried to describe it a little bit. The way I put it, though, is if Mother Teresa were alive today, she'd have a lot of friends in North Carolina. She wouldn't be lonely. The third thing, though, Clayton, is every one of those people engaged in that hard and difficult work would say that they can't make up the gap. If they believed in reading Augustine, they would say that the charity can't make up for the want of justice. And then fourth, I think they'd all say, oddly, it's getting worse. So these are real challenges for all of us, those in the public sector, the private sector, the religious community. They are challenges of public policy, and they reflect a broad reality that we are turning our backs on those locked at the bottom in a way that denies our aspirations, that denies our purported commitments, both governmental and religious and civic, and that we have to do dramatically more to take these challenges on.
A lot of people will read this book and it may come across as demoralizing, and they may say, well, I don't even know where to begin. If there were one or two small steps that our listeners could take, what would they be?
Well, first of all, let me distinguish between advocacy work, public policy work, and the remarkable charitable and otherwise religious-driven, civic-driven opportunities which exist and take place all across North Carolina. Those are related, but they are different. And both of us, I mean, all of us can do each. I think in every community in North Carolina, there is, as I said, astonishing volunteer work. You can't be out in those communities and not realize, hey, how important that is, how powerful it is, frequently how effective it is. So one small thing that everyone in the Triangle can do is pay more attention to challenges of hunger and food insecurity. People don't broadly expect that North Carolina has such hunger challenges. They don't typically know that Greensboro is frequently identified as the hungriest city in the United States. It's not something they never talk about this much. It's not talked about down in the listings and the comparisons down in the State House. But there are remarkable groups, religious groups, small groups, larger ones. The tremendous food bank system that we have here that you know about. People can get in touch with those folks, and there's great work to be done. Whether you can contribute money, you can volunteer. In the small sort of food pantries that we have all over North Carolina, this is all volunteer work, mostly religious work. A lot of people fret because it's a lot of times it's really old people like me who are doing it. So we've got a big set of challenges there. It's true with regard to poverty as well. And then now I think you have to say that it is incumbent on all of us to try and get a different government, to get a We, in fact, this is tragic, but we have a government the last 8 years that's been waging war on poor people. And charity's not going to make up for that. So there are powerful political movements in North Carolina. We have the Moral Monday movement has been an astonishing reality. I think everyone in North Carolina has to become engaged. The way I talk about it here as an equality lawyer. I'm much affected by, have been for a long time, Justice Marshall's claim when he was arguing Brown against Board of Education before the Supreme Court that he sought to advocate for the most important thing he could think of, and that was that these children be treated as entire citizens of the country in which they had been born. I love that phrase, entire citizens. It's loaded. It carries a ton. I don't think we treat low-income people as entire citizens in North Carolina. And I think we're called to do that. I think when we refuse to do it, we turn our backs on our religious commitments and our political constitutive commitments. And we lose the meaning of North Carolina. So this sounds dramatic, but the truth of it is we're involved in a fight in North Carolina right now for our own decency as a people. And it's time for all hands on deck, all hands on board. If you're waiting for us to face larger challenges, if you're sort of keeping your powder dry, I think it's time to loose the cannon, but it's time to become fully engaged as citizens and to assure that we have a government that represents our best values, not our weaknesses and fears.
Gene Nickel directs the North Carolina Poverty Research Fund at UNC and is the author of The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina. Stories from Our Invisible Citizens, absolutely a must read for your list. Move it to the top of the stack. Gene, thank you so much.
Thanks, Clay. It's great to see you. I'm a big fan of you guys' work. I'm grateful for it. So thanks for letting me visit with you.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Be sure to check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Scofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week. Have a Merry Christmas.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.